I call the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, January 28th, 2025, and the time is 8 a.m. Members present, Representative Kai Holland, Representative Mike Prox, Representative Carolyn Hall, and my co-chair, Representative Rebecca Himshute, and myself, co-chair Donna Mears. We have a quorum to connect business. I'd like to remind members and staff to please silence your cell phones. I will also note we are allowing members to use electronic devices during committee meetings. Be a little subtle about it. Just a reminder, staff and members of the audience may not approach the table, and if you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Talia Eames, and she'll take care of you. Importantly, I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Sophia Tenney, and helping us from the Juno LIO is Zachary Lawthorne at the front of the room today. Today's agenda, we just have one presentation scheduled for our first hour. We'll be hearing from Department of Corrections, Commissioner Jen Winkleman, among several staff members. The first hour, we'll have a department overview for the committee, at which point we'll gavel out, and then we will turn the second hour over to Representative Sarah Hannon to chair the first Department of Corrections Budget Subcommittee. So in this first hour, please take your time to ask lots of questions to get a general feel for the department. We will be taking the next couple of weeks in our budget subfinance committees between the Department of Corrections and the Department of Public Safety, so there will be lots of time for gaining understanding over the next couple of weeks. So please come forward, Commissioner Winkleman, and introduce yourself for the record. We also have several staff from the department with us. On the phone, we have Jeff Edwards, Executive Director of the Parole Board, Administrative Services, and Jake Wyckoff, Deputy Commissioner. In the room, we also have April Wilkerson, Deputy Commissioner, Dusty Dumont, Director of Pretrial, Probation, and Parole, Travis Welch, Director of Health and Rehabilitation Services, and Kevin Worley, Director of Administrative Services. So thank you all for bringing your team. So I know that if we've got questions, we will get an answer pretty quickly. And if it's not today, we will, I'm sure, have opportunities to follow up soon. So, Commissioner, please begin your presentation.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Co-Chair. Thanks for having us to Community and Regional Affairs. For the record, I'm Jen Winkleman, the Commissioner for the Department of Corrections, and at the table with me, I do have Deputy Commissioner April Wilkerson. As Co-Chair Mears noted, I have a great team on the line of all my directors and in the room. So, I am hoping this, while it's similar in many ways to the presentations we've done for department overviews, that we can have sort of keep it conversational, if you will, and as you mentioned, answer lots of questions. So with that, so the department was originally a division under Department of Health and Social Services, and back in 84, it, under Governor Sheffield, it moved out to its own department. It was established under an executive order. Our mission is grounded in the Alaska Constitution, which is to provide secure confinement, a process of supervised release, and reformative programming. So what I would note is that chart at the bottom shows our four divisions under the department and where they touch those the mission, essentially the Constitution. So our department has over 2,100 employees. We're actually second to DOT with number of employees, and we have a budget of just over $481 million. So this slide just breaks down a little bit more, touches on the three services that enhance the safety of our communities through the Department of Corrections. So we have noted under each of these three areas what touches which part of the mission. So secure confinement, our state facilities, as well as our community and regional jails are part of secure confinement. Supervised release is our probation and parole officers out in the community, our pretrial officers out in the community, our halfway houses, which are otherwise known as community residential centers, electronic monitoring. And then our reformative programming, which we'll get into more in later in this presentation, but the reformative programming such as behavioral health care, substance abuse treatment, sex offender management, they all fall under the reformative programming aspect of our mission. So DOC at a glance. This slide shares some unique Alaska DOC information. We're a unified correctional system. We are one of seven in the United States that is a unified system. And the way I like to explain it sort of in layman's terms is the idea that we have prisons and jails all under one department. And when something, when a state is not unified, you'll see the prisons typically under the Department of Corrections, and you'll see jails under sheriff's offices, courts, local police departments. So why that is always important is, as I get asked often, you know, what are other states doing? And what happens is not only do we have some of the geographic challenges of Alaska's size, if you will, but to compare it to another state similarly situated is a little tricky sometimes. But I definitely wanted to note that we have our jails and prisons are one and the same here in Alaska. You will note that...
Just a moment. We've got a question from my co-chair, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Mears. I'm not sure if you want questions as we go through, and then I'm not sure if my question is for this presentation or when we get to budget time, but the community jails part of this, I'd like a little more information on why Alaska runs... So you contract with local communities to fund the jail in the local community, and that's not done in most other states. It's something that we do in this state and six others. Is that when you say we're unified and that's a little bit different from many other states?
So through to the co-chair, Himshoot, what happens in our state, the contracting of the community jails, and Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson can maybe speak to this even more eloquently than I, where there is not a state facility, in communities where there's not a state facility, I would say that back in the 90s when this kind of broke out was the idea that in communities that didn't have it and because of the geographical challenge, we established, or the legislature established, a community jail program that it tucked it under the Department of Corrections. And they are short stays in there, and then they're transferred to us and they're counted, their time in custody is counted toward their time in custody. They're really ours also.
Okay, follow up.
I'll follow up.
Thank you, Chair Mears. So with those contracts, the idea is a state law has been offended. Local law enforcement is charging someone with an infraction and then holding that person until they can be moved to a state facility or until trial. So is it like a 1-2-3 day kind of thing, or could this be longer?
To the co-chair, Himshoot, it could be longer, but each community jail, you were spot on in what you were saying. It can just be a couple of days holding, but it also can be longer, but there is a maximum number of days that somebody can remain in a community jail before they will be transferred to a state facility.
Okay. Follow up. Thank you. I'm not sure if I'm in the right place here. Will we talk more about community jails down the road in budget, or is this the right time to ask more questions?
Co-Chair Himshoot, it's a great time to ask. There's a little portion of it later in the where it tucks under, but yes.
Okay. So those contracts, there had been intent language in the last year or two for those to get renegotiated. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. To the co-chair, Himshoot, I was actually going to touch on that later in the presentation, and that is due to the intent language, we did form a working group and with local leaders in local communities, certain number of communities participated in it along with AML, with our Department of Corrections, and we redid the standards. I'm proud to say they were completed at the end of last year. I just signed them this month, and I believe, and Director Dumont could speak to it more if you need more information, but I do believe that they're in effect now, but everybody, the community jails that are under them have 6 months. So by July 1st, they will be effectiveness.
Follow up.
Thank you, Chair Mears. When that contract is negotiated with a local municipality, Is it the state makes an offer and the community accepts, or is there an actual negotiation based on actual cost?
I will let Deputy Commissioner April Wilkerson answer this.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, my name is April Wilkerson, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. Part of the reevaluation was also to identify and establish budget parameters. So to ensure consistency between each of the community jails for allowable costs. Those are all taken into consideration when the budgets are developed. So each of the community jails are, as part of the standards, required to submit their budget allocation and their budget needs to the Department of Corrections, and then we will evaluate and allocate the funding that is available based on what the legislature appropriates to the department.
Follow up. Thank you, Chair Mears. So in that negotiation, so it's an annual negotiation, and a municipality, if there was a shortfall, is there any way to make them whole?
Through the chair to Co-Chair Hemshute. Yes, through the budget process, through the supplemental process, we absolutely can make those budgets whole.
Follow up. Is there a procedure for that? Is that standard in the annual negotiation that you do a look back and say, well, you actually had 10 more or 20 more folks than we anticipated, and you exceeded the contract that we provided, therefore we'll make you whole now, and then going forward we'll possibly increase the contract to avoid shortfalls?
Through the chair to Representative Hemshute, or Co-Chair Hemshute, we absolutely, we follow the legislative process, so I have seen it done both ways. I've seen the department bring forward a supplemental and ask for the funding from the legislature. I've also seen a few years ago the legislature added additional funding to the department's budget in anticipation to bring the jails up, their funding levels up. So it kind of depends on the preference. So we're open. It really is up based on what the legislature brings forward.
Final question.
Thank you.
I appreciate the indulgence to go a little bit deeper on this one. I feel the state owes due diligence to these municipalities for the burden of holding people, holding them safely and securely. So I'm looking to make sure that we're holding up our end of the work that the municipalities are doing on our behalf. So how would I know, where can I look to see if individual municipalities' needs have been met?
Through the chair to Co-Chair Hemshute, we can provide that information. We can provide what they asked for as far as their budget and what was identified. We have standards. We can provide those, as well as the budget allocation for the year.
Through the chair, I'd be grateful to get that information, plus any information you have about shortfalls that have been documented and requested to be fulfilled, or how that process works. I think I just need to go a little deeper on it. Thank you.
I'd like to recognize that Representative Ruffridge joined us several minutes ago about 8:05, and then we have a question from Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I'm wondering if we could get the intent language, the specific intent language, and the contract and the agreements. They must be written somewhere, so we're all sure to be singing off the same sheet of music.
Through the chair to Representative Proxy, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? All right, we're good for the moment, so please continue with the presentation.
All right, so you will note that we booked just under 27,000 offenders into our facilities. The unique offenders that are noted underneath means that these are individual bookings. So We have individuals that are booked into our facilities multiple times. And, for example, I previously shared that we had an inmate booked into a facility 94 times in a three-year time period. And so that equates to one remand every week and a half over those 3 years. So that's the difference between the unique offenders and how many come through the door. We will talk a little more about the breakdown of our population in the coming slides, but it is important to note that we do have nearly 10,000 individuals in our custody. So that includes those that are out on community supervision, electronic monitoring, in our halfway houses, on pretrial supervision. When you think about, we have at any time just south of 5,000 individuals in custody at the moment when this was written, was, and it fluctuates daily, nearly 4,300. And you see that we have booked in nearly 27,000 individuals into our facility. I would be remiss to not say that that means we have a significant number of releases. And so those areas of our facilities are booking, essentially, which is booking and releases are happening, are very busy in all of our facilities. So just kind of to share the volume and kind of think about it from an annual basis, they are busy facilities. So this chart is just an overview of the structure of our administration. I am really always proud to share that the names that you see up here from our executive team, we put added together is over 130 years of DOC, Alaska DOC experience. We even have some with out of state. So you will note that the dotted line to the parole board, it is because the parole board is housed budgetarily in the Department of Corrections, but it is autonomous. The executive director and his staff point directly to the parole board, and the members of the board are appointed by the governor and approved by the legislature. So a little different structure, and that is why the dotted line is there. So our FY24 major accomplishments. We partnered with the Department of Family and Community Services and API, piloting the jail-based competency restoration program to address competency issues. This allows individuals in DOC custody to participate in the restoration program while they're in our custody. So that was a big accomplishment. We have that at Anchorage Correctional Complex as well as Highland Mountain. We have initiated the utilization of alternatives to the traditional halfway houses. I always use the adage that if we do the same thing, we're going to get the same result. And so when we are dealing with complex individuals that are in our custody, I have really appreciated the idea of expanding options for community placement. So we have been working with different programs out in the community to be able to furlough or essentially move individuals, have options for individuals to move out into the community under something different than the traditional halfway house. So we have had a couple of placements at, I'll use the Alaska Addiction and Rehabilitation Services for those that are familiar with it, Nugent's Ranch, and we have been able to send individuals out there. I have appreciated this expansion and certainly want to continue to look into it. We are striving to become a zero suicide agency. We did a system-wide approach to improving outcomes related to this and bridging gaps where gaps were noticed. We had a team through, it's called Project 2025, and we had a team go to all of our facilities, all 13 of our facilities, and do a proactive needs assessment on the facility. And the idea is to identify where we can fill gaps with regard to suicide and in our facilities. So we have had essentially a follow-up with that team on each facility, and we'll be getting the comprehensive report together. And our hope is once we get that comprehensive report, of course, there will be things in it that will be tied to budget, and so down the line, we'll be noting that where we can make budget requests in regard to that that finalized report.
Questions from Representative Hemshire?
Thank you, through the chair. I can't help but notice 20% versus 100%. Why is our target not 100%? I'm sorry, on bullet point 3, to reduce in-custody annual suicide rates by 100%.
So to the co-chair Hemshute, I would agree that that is Alaska DOC's goal, is to become a zero suicide agency. That being said, Project 2025, which was a national project, was with the goal to, it is written from the national agency.
So that's the national number.
Yes.
But Alaska's number is 100%.
Yes.
I'm glad
yes.
to hear that. Thank
I say
you.
Zero suicide, and I started my sentence by saying that our goal is a zero suicide. Correct. Let's see. The including vocational, or in an effort to expand our vocational opportunities and have individuals leave our facilities with employable skills, we partnered with the Carpentry Union and implemented a pre-apprenticeship carpentry program at Highland Mountain and Wildwood Correctional Center. I am really proud to say we were able to get that off the ground relatively quickly with their partnership, and we've actually had a couple of cohorts go through the program and complete it already, and I think it's a small number, but we have seen success in that, and the idea is to grow that, and not only grow carpentry, but also look at where there are gaps in employment out in the community with things like the electrical union and the plumbers union, and so to be able to mirror something along those same lines, and we have it with the welding program, the iron workers, and we now are proud to say that we had it in this last year with the carpentry union. We implemented a pilot program for tablets. We implemented a pilot program at Highland Mountain. They have very limited options on them right now, but it's our hope that legislation might get through the finish line and get tablets more broadly deployed in our facilities as a great efficiency at within our facilities.
Can I follow?
And finally,
got a follow-up from Co-Chair Hemshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, apparently I'm dealing with questions this morning, but on that tablet project, the court system part of it, does that mean certain court hearings and procedures can happen on the tablet, or is it so that inmates know when their next court date is? How is that part working? And just overall, has that been a successful pilot?
So, Co-Chair Hemshute, great question. I meant to touch on that. The court tablets is separate than our pilot project for tablets. The court system has given us, loaned us tablets for utilization for court hearings. And we have that going at Goose Creek. And part of that, and I'll touch on it here in a little bit, about transferring inmates between facilities, that it makes it an efficiency, essentially, if they can. I believe the Second Judicial District up north has been using it quite frequently. And the judges are able to have virtual court hearings with defendants in our custody. That's been at Goose Creek. And then we just recently, as of last week, got the infrastructure going at Highland Mountain in our women's facility, and have been working with the court system on that as well. So we're meeting on a regular basis to see where we can continue to expand this. So a little different than the pilot tablet program that is running, that is it becomes the inmates, and it's a Department of Corrections tablet that is, you know, assigned to an inmate, and their programming and their individual things are on it. These are court tablets that would be used by anybody that has a court hearing and transferred between inmates.
Quick follow-up.
Representative.
Thank you. Through the chair, then, for the court tablets, it's the decision of the inmate whether their court proceedings are done virtually or in person. They get to make that call?
To the co-chair Hemshute, the judge will typically state how they want the defendant to participate. And so it depends on what the hearing is, essentially.
Okay, thank you.
Another question, Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I guess in all of these programs here, you must have this is the goals and objectives. This is a problem we're trying to address. We want to go from here where we are to there where we want to be. And then there must be some little description somewhere, internally at least, of how you do that so that the people at corrections know what you're doing, or you want it, wanting to them to do. Is that available somewhere for us to look at to evaluate individual programs?
So through the chair to Representative Prox, yes. I think we would need to know more specifics on what, if you're wanting results on education, we keep that data and we can let you know what that looks like, how many completions we've had, how many successful completions, enrollments, successful completions. I don't know that we have something where it's, we would need to get into specifics.
Right.
But yes, absolutely.
Right. And follow up. I don't think we would have time to do that as a committee, but individually I'm curious, and I want to get more oriented towards what we're supposed to do in the Executive Budget Act, and that is roughly that. Find a problem, measure it, set it, how are you going to go from here to there and why, and review it in the future. But that's what I'm interested in. We'll have to do that individually, I think.
Question from Representative Holland.
All right, thank you, through the chair. Appreciate the presentation, but I think, you know, my colleague here is kind of touching at the thing that I'm trying to get my head around, which is I look at a program like this from the standpoint of understanding kind of what are the levels of activity and the different major activities. You know, what's the activity in terms of number of incarcerations, number of people coming out, recidivism. And then I look for the trends, going up, going down. And then I look for comparisons. How can we compare the level of activity that we see to other benchmark areas? And to follow up on his suggestion, it would really be helpful to me to see a little different slice of what's going on here in terms of what are the levels of activity in each of these three main pillars, what are the trends, and how could we compare that to other areas that I think would then begin to give me a tool to be able to identify where are the successes that we can build on, where are the gaps and needs that maybe we can address in terms of other changes in budgets or policy areas that would improve the system. Because I've lots of questions here I've been kind of holding back on to, you know, many of the different pieces of the puzzle, but I'm realizing that what I need is a little clearer system view of what's happening right now. And I appreciate the updates and current accomplishments, but as a new member, I'm not seeing the bigger picture. I'll leave it there for now. Thank you.
So through the chair to Representative Holland, I look forward to meeting with you and individually, and I can certainly walk through. I think your point is well made, and that is something we it's a challenge of ours on a daily basis as we look at our system, if you will, because there are so many things different to measure what we're doing. Recidivism rates, our population, staff retention, there's all these pieces, program completions. Are they programs that folks are taking and they're able to transfer out into the community? So I do look forward to talking more with you in detail about that and maybe dialing in on things that are of interest in your purview, if you will. So.
Excellent. Any other questions before we continue? All right, that's it till we're ready for the next batch.
I was just at that last bullet, I just was going to comment. I'm going to touch on this a little later. My number one guiding principle in this department has been the health and well-being of my staff, and that is the idea that if we take care of staff, they will take care of those that are in our care. You can see on this bullet some of the expansion that we have done within the wellness program. So. And now I will talk about our challenges. We have amazing staff. I always want to give them a shout out to those that are in the room, those that are listening online. I say thank you. As you might imagine, we have a pretty strong, vigorous vetting process. And because of this, it can be challenging to find qualified staff, qualified applicants. It takes a special person to want to work in corrections. whether you are a correctional officer, a probation officer, a medical professional, a kitchen worker, or administrative staff, you're in a state of hypervigilance, particularly when you are working in this field. And to stay in a state of hypervigilance for hours on end is not healthy. And so it really does take a special person to work in this department and to retain these folks. And so, as you might imagine, the recruitment and retention of staff is one of our biggest challenges. I'm going to touch on that a little bit later in the presentation, where we're at with vacancy rates, and I think it kind of goes to some of the questions that have been asked. With regard to the management and movement of our population, I just always want to state on the record that we're that downward agency. So any changes in laws with law enforcement, with laws with the courts, with the public defenders, that affects our population, and it's very tricky to predict. We can have one catastrophic case that disrupts the entire plan. We have a fight involving multiple inmates. We might have to move them around. We might send them to the hospital. And these things cost money, and they are hard to plan for. So when I talk about our accomplishments and challenges, they clearly come at a cost. I do recognize this is not a budget hearing, and we're going to get to that in the next presentation, but I did want to share that on the record that we are working diligently with the OMB director on this budgeting process. The controlling the cost and the prevalence of chronic illness amongst our population is a challenge. Our chief medical officer, previous chief medical officer, who is now the chief medical officer for the state, provided me a data point some time ago that over half of our population that comes to us with chronic medical and mental health problems, compounded obviously by years of, and for many, substance abuse. It's an expensive challenge to tackle this, particularly when there are limited resources within our facility, back to that recruiting and retaining staff, but also in our communities. We're seeing the same challenges. And then the medical costs, they've just skyrocketed, and providers are hard to come by. We are the largest mental health provider in the state, not something that we want to be. That means that these costs are increasing there. Our facilities are aging, the upkeep of our facilities and the upkeep of the technology to keep our facilities going makes things challenging. Often feels like we are plugging one hole and six others spring a leak. So,
I have a quick comment. As far as mental health treatment, substance misuse treatment, we've discussed in the past that one of the burdens on your department is that there's lack of facilities outside of your department within the community. Can you?
Yes, Co-Chair Mears. Yes, absolutely. There's the resources are not in the community, as well as it's hard to hire professionals in this area within our facilities. So as we're seeing that population grow, it's becoming even harder to hire staff to treat those individuals. What I will say is the idea of tablets and the idea of getting the ability to have some telehealth on there, our hope is to widen the net at what might be available out there with regard to that.
Thank you. Quick follow-up. So would it be fair to say that if there's a choice to treat folks within your custody and to treat folks within the community, it'd be a lot cheaper to treat folks within the community instead of in your facility?
Co-Chair Mears, yes.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay, so this is the first of four divisions, five divisions if we include the parole board, but this is the first of four divisions under our budget and administration. This division provides secure confinement with an emphasis on public safety, and it starts the process of programming and community integration. While it definitely encompasses our state correctional centers, it's also responsible for other areas mentioned in this slide, such as our chaplaincy program, our community residential centers, otherwise known as our halfway houses, our electronic monitoring, to name a few. You will note that we have a transportation unit. We have a standing delegation with the Department of Public Safety, to provide transport of inmates for population management, so moving them in between our facilities, and for medical appointments. I would note that in FY24, this transportation unit conducted over 6,800 outside medical transports, which was a total of 629 more than the year prior. So over 6,800 medicals are going from our facilities to a hospital through this transportation unit. And then I would say that we also have our out-of-state unit, and those are individuals are placed out of state. Sometimes if they are a high-profile or a law enforcement case that can't be housed somewhere else within our facilities, if they have separatees, which is when they can't be around others, somebody else, gang affiliations, or if they have severe medical. And we have six out-of-state right now. We have two that are prior law enforcement, and we have four that are under separatees, so they could not be housed anywhere in the state safely because of affiliations with other inmates.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have a question from Representative Holland.
Sure, thank you. Through the chair, and I think maybe you touched on where I was trying to go. I wanted to understand, at least at a high level, a little bit more about the current allocation or placement of people out of the state versus in-state. What number of people, what's the trend on that? And I think maybe you touched a little bit on that, but if you could kind of summarize kind of the high-level view of what's the strategy right now on the use? I have this recollection that in the past we've relied much more heavily on out-of-state prisons to house people, and that's been a concern that we wanted to keep them closer to Alaska. So could you back up half a step and just summarize for me how that fits into the structure of the institutions?
So, Co-Chair Holland, great question. Essentially, when Goose Creek Correctional Center was built, all the prisoners out of state were brought back. So the only time we use out-of-state placements currently is if we have individuals that can't be housed with anyone else, or there's some serious medical that would cost us more to be bringing them back and forth for certain treatments, or law enforcement, prior law enforcement will get transferred out. Not all the time, but if we cannot house them safely in this state. I will say that in preparing for this presentation, I looked at the notes of what we had out of state last year to this year. We had seven out of state last year. We have six this year. So I think the trends stay, since we've moved everybody back, it's pretty small.
Good. Thank you for now.
Thank you, Representative Hall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Commissioner, I'm wondering, was there any cost savings realized by bringing folks back who are incarcerated outside, or is it cost neutral, or is it more expensive to have them housed in state?
I will let through the co-chair to Representative Hall. I will let Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson speak to this.
Good morning. For the record, this is April Wilkerson again. Through the chair to Representative Hall, it actually is more expensive to house within the state of Alaska. That is something that was thoroughly discussed with the reopening and the building of Goose Creek. However, there's also that other benefit. It did bring jobs back to Alaska. It also brought that population back closer to their communities where they're going to be releasing. It made it more accessible for those family members as well. So while it's monetarily more expensive, there's that long-term benefit that was at the time and consistently has been a more of a benefit than the actual numbers.
Thank you.
To follow up? No, thank you. Okay. We have a question from Co-Chair Hemstreet.
Thank you, Chair Mears. I want to go back up to the inmate transportation and point of arrest. You have a K-9 unit listed there. There's been interest in my district in community policing with K-9 units, so we've done a little bit of digging on that. How many K-9 units do you have, and how are they used?
So to the co-chair, Hemshoot, we currently have two K-9 units, and I could let Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff on the line speak to specifics on how they are used. We will partner with other agencies. I am aware of that. We'll use them in our community corrections. We'll use them in our facilities. So kind of a wide variety. They are both located in South Central. And so it does become a little trickier on the road system, but it does get a little trickier to utilize them elsewhere. And if you want more information, we can get him
I would appreciate that. And I guess my question is also, there's like dual uses. You can have a search and rescue function. You can have a drug interdiction function. Is there another way to use a canine unit that I'm not aware of? So I would like, just if it's okay, to go to.
Yeah. Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff, did you hear Co-Chair Hemshute's question?
I did. Good morning. For the record, Jake Wyckoff, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Corrections. Through the chair to Co-Chair Hemshute, I believe your question is, how many units do we have and what do they do? The commissioner is correct. We do have two canine units with two canine operators. And our dogs are a little, or our canines are somewhat unique in that they are trained to detect, I'll call it institutional contraband. So they have a little more awareness of different drugs and contraband items, for example, alcohol, marijuana, as well as tobacco, which are some items that police canines typically do not alert on. And they're used to conduct targeted searches within our institutions or halfway houses. And there is a bit of time spent in the community working with other law enforcement agencies as well. I hope that answers your question. And if not, I'm still here.
Thank you.
Please continue with your presentation.
So this slide shows the visual of the institutional capacity and locations at the start of the calendar year. You will note that they are all below capacity, and this is no mistake. We have worked really hard to keep them below capacity, to keep each facility below capacity for the last 3 years. I feel strongly that this contributes to staff wellness and safer facilities. I would also note that just under capacity doesn't necessarily mean that there is available space. We will have certain populations, women, mental health, or some sort of a specialized population in an area, and depending on the numbers, we have to utilize the whole MOD or the whole unit to house that the specialized housing. So just because you will see gaps in that doesn't necessarily mean we are moving folks around. As I mentioned earlier, we are moving folks around the state all day, every day. The appreciation that staff and our inmates feel from keeping these under capacity is one of the first things we're shared when we do a site visit, because it may mean that a gym is open in a certain area. It may mean that programming can be open in a certain area. So we're very thoughtful in our decisions on moving folks around, because there's a lot of factors that play into movement of our prisoners.
Question from Co-Chair Hemshute.
Sorry to interrupt. Thank you. Through the chair, I'm just noticing that Lemon Creek looks pretty full, and curious about, with the renovations there, will that light blue line move up? Does that make more space? And then how long do you expect those renovations? Like, the thing is still built where it's built. Are we expecting the investment in those renovations to result in 50 years, 10 years? How long do we expect all MODs to be open at Lemon Creek?
So to the Co-Chair Hemshute, great question, and I will touch on the first part, and then I will allow Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson to touch on the second part of the question. First part of the question is I would note that that Lemon Creek's count on here has been adjusted by the 102 beds that we took offline. So what you will see is it will move up once it is open and fully operational. That being said, I will let Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson speak to the kind of the investment in what's happening and what we're looking as far as time frame.
Thank you. Through the chair to Co-Chair Hemshute. The renovations are expected to be completed the end of March, with final inspections and an occupancy by the end of April. And then we'll do a phased soft opening to ensure that everything is operational, the security functions are running smoothly, and that there's no hiccup. So we do plan to have those beds back open and fully, Lemon Creek back to full operations by July 1st. As far as the investment, we have been working with Department of Transportation. They're overseeing this project. And they feel that with the investment of renovating and fixing Lemon Creek and the issues there, that we should see an expanded life expectancy of at least 10 to 12, 20 years.
Follow-up. Sorry, is that for all of Lemon Creek or just the section under repair? And what was our investment for that 10 to 20 years?
Through the chair to co-chair Hemshute. The total investment right now, we have $12 million on the books for this. My understanding is it is the full facility. We have been keeping an eye on the west wing where to make sure that there's no groundwater issues on that side of the facility. So far, and I don't want to jinx this, but so far everything has been smooth. But again, DOT can't predict what's going to happen with some of the backside of the mountain there. We are looking at preventative to see if there are other efforts that maybe the state or the department can take to ensure the full life expectancy of that facility.
Follow up.
So through the chair then, it all sounds a little tenuous with Lemon Creek. Is anyone exploring complete relocation, looking at a different, like that would be a huge lift, and not one that I want us to have to make or a future legislature to have to make at the last minute. So for Lemon Creek and all the facilities, do you have a 10-year, 20-year, you know, we can't predict the populations that you'll need to house. I don't know if there's any way to do that. But in terms of this facility in Juneau being somewhat at risk, do we need to do a complete relocation, and do we have eyes on that?
Mm-hmm. Through the chair to co-chair Hemshute, that is our facility. We have a facility capital improvement unit within our department, and that is something that they are looking. We have an old one, but we are dusting it off to take a look at not only Lemon Creek, but evaluate all of the facilities. I know that in 2012, the recommendation was Fairbanks needed to be fully replaced. We received an estimate at that time. It was about $150 million to relocate and rebuild Fairbanks. But that is a plan to dust that off, evaluate all facilities with their current maintenance and deferred maintenance issues to bring it forward to really know where we are at with all of the institutions just based on their age.
Just a quick comment to thank you for like the institutional knowledge to be able to look back to 2012 and know what was happening is really helpful. So thank you.
Please continue.
This slide shares the gender for our unsentenced and sentenced population. We're often asked about our unsentenced and sentenced population. And we have finally seen, and with the male population, we have seen the sentenced go back up above unsentenced. So this was very recent. I would say late October, November-ish, we started to see the numbers flip-flop. So what we were seeing for a while was unsentenced population higher than our sentenced population. And what you're seeing with our male population right now is it actually did flip-flop to where our sentenced population is a little bit higher. Where that is beneficial in our world is that our sentenced population, they will typically engage in programming. They're less transient, where the unsentenced population may get out tomorrow, and so they will flip-flop that direction, or they will not participate in programming as much. There are likely several factors that have attributed to this. I know the court has been working on their backlog. Hiring within even the public defenders and the Department of Law so that things are moving through the system a little bit faster. I think that that all is contributing to sentenced and unsentenced population shifting a bit. You'll still notice that with our female population, there are quite a large number, about a 50% more difference in the unsentenced versus sentenced population.
Question, Co-Chair Hemshire.
Thank you, through the chair. Commissioner Winkleman, could we get a look back and look like at the last 10 years, just the annual average? We know that the courts are working on this, and I don't think that there's anything you can do, but it does impact what you do and the success of our system. So if we could just kind of, I know that COVID really messed things up, but I just also want to know a little further back than that. And then also, what's a national comparison? Where do we stand nationally as far as unsentenced folks?
So, Co-Chair Hemshute, to the first question, absolutely, we can get that. And it's great to be looking at in correlation even with your last question, because I was going to comment on the idea that deciding on what to do with facilities and where we're going as a system, as we're seeing fluctuations in population, makes a huge difference. And as we all know, the world pivoted a couple of years ago, and so it's really, it's been somewhat of I guess I'll use the analogy, perfect storm in trying to figure all of this out. I'm sorry, what was your second?
Nationally, What is the unsentenced population? And I know it changes, I'm sure, every day. So if we just took our annual average, how do we compare with other states?
So, Co-Chair Hemshute, thank you for that. We compare very similarly. So we're seeing in other areas a high unsentenced population. But where I will say, and go back to that slide I said at the beginning, the uniqueness of us being a unified system makes it a little bit challenging because they house them in a different, for the most part, for 43 states, they house them in a different system before they come over to correction. So hard to compare, but the ones that we do compare with as close as we can, and I'll use like the Vermont, I think Vermont is a good area to compare to. They have the same challenges with a higher unsentenced population. And again, I think it goes back to all systems are dealing with the strain of kind of what happened a few years ago and playing catch up.
Right. Thank you.
Good. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, and I think Representative Hemshute's question, your response is kind of getting mostly to where I'm going. I just want to add, as you look at that information and perhaps prepare that comparison or trend of the average over time, I'd be really interested in also seeing the distribution of how long people are in at any one point, because, you know, the flaw of averages is that, you know, the average may be one number, but I'm really more concerned about how long are people staying in. If the unsentenced are in there for a relatively short time and we've got a really good job of moving them in and out and getting them sentenced, that's great, you know, or do we have a bunch of people that are stuck there for a really long time unsentenced? So in addition to the averages, if we can get a distribution of how long they're in and how has that changed, are we making progress on speeding up people being unsentenced for a shorter period of time? Thank you.
So through the co-chair to Representative Holland, absolutely we can get that for you. And I think it's a great question, because I do think that the uniqueness of how long people are staying and how many cases they're coming in on, we're going to actually go to the next slide, and it talks specifically about this shows the population that was on the previous slide and what they are serving time for, both in the unsentenced world and the sentenced world. But what we're also seeing is folks come in on multiple charges. And so what this slide reflects is the most serious charge that they come in on. So if you look at the unsentenced, you'll note that they're coming in on their most certain serious charges. Then when we move to the sentenced, the graph changes a little bit because of plea deals and what happens at jury trial, essentially. So it is a great question. We can get to that answer. And then I think this also touches on it a little bit with regard to what we're seeing with – and when somebody comes in on a more serious crime, they're going to spend more time. And so what are we seeing as far as length of sentence from there as well?
Commissioner, we have a couple more questions, I think, on the previous side. Did you need a follow-up?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I think, when I was thinking about this last night, it seemed like this would be in a real interesting area to focus on, the sentence versus unsentence. My understanding, for instance, is that the Fairbanks facility is just a pretrial facility, but there's people that have been in there for several years. I don't remember what the average length of stay, but I guess my expectation, and maybe by that the public that I interact with, is that somebody is in an unsentenced status for a very short time. It may be months, and I don't know what it would be, but you wouldn't expect a lot of treatment and services, a lot of corrections, until you're sentenced. But if we have such a large, maybe that's volume, I don't know, people sitting around for years and years and years waiting for a trial, we got a problem. But that's a very interesting way to look at this, I think, to me.
Yeah. So through the chair to Representative Prox, you're absolutely right in that we do have individuals. Fairbanks is a pretrial facility, and the idea is to get them moved through and get them into one of our sentenced facilities. I will say that due to delays in for many different reasons, absolutely, we will have individuals sitting with us for years in an unsentenced status. Mm-hmm. And I think I don't want to speak to exactly what we can get, but with regard to data that we can get, I think we can also show, when Representative Holland asked about length of stay of individuals, right. I think we can also show where folks have stayed in an unsentenced status for a period of time that would give an idea of how long folks are sitting in an unsentenced status as well.
Right. Yeah, I just to follow up comment, I really think that's important, that it would be when I think of unsentenced, I'm thinking of Mayberry and the guy sitting in the county jail doing nothing for a very short time. And when I toured the facility was designed, well, there was many more services offered than I would have expected. And maybe we need to look at how that works out. I don't know. Don't have the answer. I have the question, not the answer.
Thank you. I'd like to note that Representative Hannon joined us at 8:52. We have an outstanding question by Representative Hall, and then I'd like to just get through that following slide 11 that you started, and then we'll have plenty of opportunity another day to finish the rest of the overview. So, Representative Hall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Commissioner, I'm hoping you could explain a little bit about the disparity, and it's a pretty large disparity, with the women who are unsentenced versus the men who are unsentenced. Could you talk about that a little bit?
So, through the chair to Representative Hall, I looked at that myself, and I cannot explain what it is. I am not certain what, if it's, yeah, I really don't know. I don't know if they're not moving through as quickly. I don't know if they are, these are point in time, and if at the point that we gave this, January 1st, gave this, provided this data, if we had a bunch of, a lot of remands that had come in, so then that capturing. We are seeing a higher unsentenced population in our female facility, which is Highland Mountain. But I can't, I don't know. And we can certainly talk about it offline and get back to you if there is something that we're able to come to. But I thought about that as we were putting this presentation together. So,
quick follow-up.
Thank
you, Commissioner. Similar to what was being discussed about having additional information going back however many years, but then also national comparisons. Could you also perhaps break it out by month when it comes to like different trends when it comes to the female population? Just kind of curious if maybe, I don't know, there's a seasonality associated with it.
Through the chair to Representative Hall, absolutely. And we do see at different times of year, and sometimes different locations have different times of year, and it may be weather-related. Up north might be when it gets really cold, and you'll see different things, different trends, but we can absolutely get that information for you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's do a quick on slide 11, and maybe that's where we pick up next time as well.
So as noted, that this slide represents the type of crime that the population we referenced on the previous slide are in custody for.
And like I mentioned, it's important to note that sometimes our folks in our custody have multiple charges. So this slide is going to represent the most serious charge. You'll note that the bulk of our population is crimes against a person and our sex offender population. While we recognize they are one and the same, sex offender population is going to be a crime against a person, we know we get a lot of inquiries about numbers of sex offenders in the system, and so we broke it down on here for you all to be able to see. As you can note, that combined, these do make up a bulk of our population. I would also note that these slides do not include our federal offenders. So we do have federal offenders in custody. And we have approximately 130 right now.
All righty. So that will conclude our presentation for today. Our next meeting for CNRA is on Thursday, January 30th at 8 a.m. On the agenda, we will be seeing the same type of presentation, overview of Department of Public Safety with Commissioner James Cockrell. And then, again, same format, second hour, we'll be starting our budget overview. The week after next, we will continue with the budget overview, so there won't be a regular Community and Regional Affairs meeting. Our first hour will be Department of Public Safety, and our second hours will be Department of Corrections for at least next week and potentially the week after that. Did you have a quick question, Representative Paul?
Just a quick question, please, Chair. With the additional questions that we have today that we've not gotten to, would you like us to send those questions to the co-chairs to then convey? Would you like us to work directly with the commissioner? How can we follow up with some of the loose ends that we've not gotten to today?
Representative Hall, there'll be plenty of time to be chatting with Department of Corrections, both within the budget subcommittee process. But if you've got more detailed things, I believe you can always have an individual meeting with the commissioner.
Okay, thank you.
Seeing there's no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 9:01 a.m. Thank you.